Well, you know, we have windstorms every once in a while, and it's always amazing. I've said this before that, you know, we get some great tree that's blown down that you thought would never come down because it's just big and it's huge and circumference, and the thing's been there forever. And you think, how in the world did that thing come down? It's such a strong tree. And then you get to realize, like you see in this picture here, that the inside of that tree is filled with rot and decay. It's been compromised. The integrity of that tree has been compromised. And the same thing can be considered, or at least that's part of the underlying danger in considering any man for a leadership office. You want to make sure that his integrity has not been compromised. You want to make sure that what you see visibly, outwardly, publicly is also what he really is inwardly, and that his integrity is intact there. You don't want problems to undermine or compromise that effectiveness. I think of Judas when I think of this. Here Judas was in the circle of Jesus' closest friends and followers there, the 12 disciples, and yet Judas had a bad heart. And even though outwardly he did all of what the disciples did, he went and preached to the cities of Israel. He sat and listened to the master. He may well have performed miracles in the master's name and done all these things. And yet his heart was compromised, and that affected his leadership and affected ultimately his life. A man's outward, visible, public display of character is not the only thing to look for. What really also needs to be considered is what he is when he's not here in this assembly with us. Because we all know that here, everyone's putting on their best face, their best foot forward, their best dress, their best behavior, well, at least usually, right? I mean, that's what we're striving for. And so it's not a stretch to say, well, you know, ever since I've known thus and so, this person, you know, he's always shown great discretion in the assembly. Well, that might be true, but that doesn't mean that he shows that where it counts. And that begs the question, how important is a man's family and the management of his home in the appointment of a shepherd? Apparently, it is very important because God stresses that in his word, that very thing right there. A man's home, his family life, is really a measurement of his stewardship and his leadership over people and the application of these God-given principles that we've been looking at over these last several weeks. An unstable, unchaotic, unmanaged home life indicates a long-term problem with long-term consequences. And these are things we don't want to bring upon ourselves. We don't want to appoint a man who shows instability, because that instability will ultimately negatively affect us here. And we're just asking for trouble is what I'm saying. So the role of the overseer of the congregation is directly related to the management of the family. That is not me that said that. That's the Holy Spirit that's putting those two things together for us. And we want to appreciate that. We looked at 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 4 and 5 last week, and we'll see it again this week. The message there is clear. We only want to appoint a man who can manage his household. We do not want a tree that is ready to fall. We want a strong and resilient tree, if you will. We want one that's able to weather the times, weather the difficulty of this responsibility, and so on. So the rest of the lesson is, well, what does this mean? And that's when we get into, first of all, stewardship. In Titus chapter 1, verse 7, if you're there, that was part of our reading. It says the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, and so on. But I just want to focus on that first part. Above reproach as God's steward. What does that mean, steward? Usually when we think of stewardship, we think of finances. We think of money or the management of money, and certainly that is a realm of stewardship. It is not the only realm, however. The general idea behind stewardship is you're taking care of something that has been entrusted to you by someone else and to whom you will give account for what was entrusted to you by the one who entrusted it to you. So there's a responsibility given to you and an accountability required of you. That's what stewardship is in the most basic sense. The word steward actually comes from the Greek word oikonomia, or oikonomiai, if you want to pronounce it more correctly. I'm not a Greek scholar. Don't pretend to be one. But, you know, the word breaks down to literally that first part of the word oiko means home. Nomia, or nomos, comes from the Greek word for law. Literally, it means the law of the house. When we talk about stewardship, we're talking about a steward who is really the governor or the manager of the house. Whatever the house is, whether it's a church or his own home or a business or whatever, we're simply talking about that. And by the way, our English word economy comes from that Greek word, oikonomeos. And so we get that word economy in the older sense, the more archaic sense, to mean just simply an administration of something, a management of something, not just simply about money. So it's the manager of an overseer in a house or an employee who's put in that capacity, a governor, a ruler, an administrator. One of the specific areas of examination for the candidate of an elder is, obviously, is he a good steward? And how can you tell that? Is really what the question comes to us as. How do you know that? Well, you look at his home life. I'm not saying that you need to go to his home and spend a few weeks there. What I'm saying is that you just need to be observant as to what his home life is producing and how he conducts himself in his private environment. Okay, and that includes, of course, his finances, tangible things, personal possessions, property, etc., things that are entrusted to him. How does he take care of those things? It also includes intangible things, things you can't always quantify, like time, opportunities, studies, prayers, discipline, self-mastery. How does he handle that? And you're not going to have answers to all these questions, absolutely, that's not the point, but I think you can get a pretty good idea, right, of what kind of person he is by looking, generally at least, at his private life. What kind of people does he involve himself with, and how does he handle them? People is the most important thing to manage because, well, people are more important than things, and people are more important than money. So you look at his physical family, his friends, his wife, his children, his congregation. Is he warm? Is he cold? Is he approachable or is he standoffish? What kind of person is he? Is he someone who cares about his family? How do you know that? Can you see that care? Or does he just tell you that? Or have you just come to believe that as a matter of fact? The management of people is often complex and involved, and of course it requires some skill level there at some point, good social or communicative skills. It's not for the shy, the amateur, or certainly not the unwilling. We don't want to put a man in office who doesn't like people, okay? We don't want to put someone in office who is shy and terribly reserved and quite the extrovert or introvert, rather, I should say at that point. And we don't want someone who is just unwilling to do the work that a shepherd requires. We need that man then to be observant. We need someone who has a keen observation of what is really happening. What is really being said? What is really the underlying problem? What is really bothering somebody? I'm not saying he'll be always accurate in that, but we need someone who has shown some proficiency in being able to do that over time. Perhaps in your own personal experience as well, that he has shown proficiency in that. We need someone with people skills and diligence in those people skills. A good manager of people requires, as you know if you've ever done it, great patience and listening skills and a measure of diplomacy and tactfulness. We don't want a tactless man. We don't want an undiplomatic man. We want a man who knows people well enough to know how to manage them. And that's a really important thing to consider here. We also want to consider, how does he manage himself? What does his self-discipline look like? How does he manage his time? Is he efficient or does he waste a lot of time? I realize that not all of this can be measured at any one given event, and it certainly can't be measured in a church building. You can't tell what kind of person I am entirely by just watching me here in this building. Okay? You can determine some things about me, but you really can't know who I am or who someone else is simply by watching us here. And on that note, then, we want someone who is not, quick to speak and quick to anger. We want someone who is quick to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger, just like James 1:19 says. And if you look at a man and if you realize that how he deals with his wife and children will be a direct reflection of what he will deal with the congregation, then you know what I'm talking about. If you have a man who is always snapping at his wife and barking orders at his children or ignoring them altogether, not listening to them, cutting them off, constantly shutting them down or whatever it is, we can just imagine that that's going to happen eventually in his role as a shepherd if we were to appoint him that way. So then begs the question, why would we appoint him that way if we know that about him? Does he show bitterness? Does he hold grudges? Is he passively aggressive, which refers to not directly retaliating all the time, but kind of going behind the scenes to, you know, jab from behind, kind of those kidney punches, if you know what I'm talking about there. Takes that backdoor approach to respond or vindicate or retaliate. Or is he a kind person? Is he tenderhearted? Is he a forgiving person? Does he truly forgive people? Not many people can do all of these things well. And I'm going to tell you, no man or woman can do all of these things perfectly. So we're not looking for a perfect person. You'll never find one. But we are looking for someone who has shown proficiency or even mastery in these areas. And it takes a special kind of person to do that. Observe this man in the company of his wife and in his home life, and you will know whether or not he is that kind of man. Does he humble himself by putting others' interests before his own? Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4 says that that's exactly what we all should be doing, but especially him, because he's supposed to lead by example. So if a man will not spend quality time with his family for their sake, not only for his pleasure or for his schedule, then you can be certain that he's not going to spend quality time with his spiritual family as well. Or if he claims that, well, no, I'll put the church first ahead of my family, well, that's not right either, because his family should be the most important group of people that he manages. So he shouldn't manage the church at the expense of his family, but he should be able to manage his family and manage the church and keep both of those in their rightful contexts. He cannot be so self-absorbed and preoccupied with his own life that he will not make time for those whom God has put under his care. Members of a congregation should not have to always work around an elder's personal life in order to get the work of the congregation done. The key word I just said in all that was always. Everyone has a personal life, and they're entitled to a personal life. And just because you call an elder up in the middle of the night or when he's ready to go to, you know, his child's, rehearsal or something like this, or, and if it's not an emergency, and then you accuse him, and I've said this in so many words before, and then you accuse him of not caring because he didn't drop everything in his personal life to come to you. That's just not being fair. He does have a personal life, and he's entitled to that. If it is an emergency, then you need to state it as such. And by the way, your lack of preparation does not constitute an emergency on his part, right? My professors told me that in school, and I remember that very clearly, all right? So just keep that in mind, that doesn't mean it's an emergency just because you said so. So, but at the same time, in that fairness, in that balance of what we're saying here, that if there is something that needs to be done and you can never seem to sit down with the elder because he's always so busy doing his own thing, then that's an elder who really doesn't understand his work as a shepherd, doesn't understand his dedication to the congregation as its leader, doesn't really understand what God has called him to, and really should not have been called to that in the first place if we knew about that ahead of time. It's our responsibility to hopefully identify not only those good men who should be appointed, but also recognize that there are some men who shouldn't be. That's our responsibility as a congregation to do that. Once again, Titus 1:7, the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed. We want an even-tempered, mild-mannered, or well-disciplined man, well-disciplined man. We want a man who is manageable and is also managing. We want a man who is able to receive instruction as well as to give instruction. An elder who refuses to learn anything beyond what he already knows or refuses to implement new teaching is really a poor leader. He's really being a hypocrite because he wants everyone else to learn things and change and modify, and yet he won't. So we don't need that sort of man. We want what I said there, a man who is willing to be taught and a man who can teach. All right, shifting gears a little bit, or really just kind of embellishing on what we said in a more specific way, however you look at that. An elder ought to be a man with a healthy and loving marriage. The reason I can say that is because Christ's headship of his church is a healthy and loving role and produces a healthy and loving relationship, a marriage. And I'm not talking about marriage in a figurative sense here. Now we're talking about the elder's marriage, his actual marriage with his wife. And it might seem odd to you, as it has to me in the past, that nothing is said specifically in 1 Timothy 3 or in Titus 1 about the man's wife, the wife of the candidate who we're considering to be an elder. And yet nothing is said specifically about his walk with the Lord either. Have you ever noticed that? In fact, I pointed out last week there's a bunch of things that aren't said specifically about this man, and yet they are part of the basic or foundational expectations. When I say a man should have a healthy and loving wife, or healthy and loving marriage here, let me get that straight, that word healthy or loving, those words are not open to subjective interpretation. We're basing that on what God says a healthy and loving relationship should look like, not what you think you have. Because if we asked everyone here, do you have a healthy and loving relationship with your husband or wife, it probably all of us would say, especially in the company of that spouse, well, of course, that's what we want to believe, perhaps, and that's what we want others to believe. But that doesn't necessarily stand to the scripture. That's not how that works there. It is possible that a husband and wife can describe their marriage as healthy and loving and they still be not following the biblical pattern for what a marriage ought to look like. Okay, so let's not descend into subjective terminology and emotional terminology especially and say, well, this is what I feel like this person is. So it doesn't really matter what you feel. What we're interested in is the facts. What does the evidence say? You all know, whether you're married or not, you should know that marriage, the marriage relationship, is a complex, personal, cooperative kind of intimate fellowship that does require management, mutual understanding, communication, a whole lot of mercy and grace, tolerance and forgiveness. And these are all things that shepherds need to guide and manage their flock. So what I'm saying here, what I'm not saying is that the marriage relationship is on par with an elder's relationship with a congregation. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is, and what we should extract from the scriptures here, is that the tools that are necessary in order for a marriage to be successful and functional and healthy as God would deem it, those same tools carry over into the shepherd's work in his role as a leader and an overseer of that congregation. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying that he's married to the congregation. That just gets weird, okay? We are saying, however, that the tools are there and that the tools used in one relationship do carry over and are used in another relationship. That's all we are getting at there. We need to find a man whose wife is in subjection to him. That sounds almost hard to say in our today's volatile, hypersensitive climate, because immediately people bristle, like, I don't want to be in submission. I want to be my own woman, some woman might say, or some man will be like, I don't want to tell my wife she needs to be in submission. She'll kill me, okay, or something like that. We're driven by what the society out there is telling us about that. Put all that aside for just a minute and understand that what God is saying doesn't care what society is saying, and neither should you. What God says is that we need a man whose wife is in submission to him. That is necessarily implied in his management of his home life. A man with an unsubmissive wife will not be an asset as an elder to our congregation. He will become a liability and a detriment to the group. His wife undermines his own credibility as a leader. He is unable to provide personal examples of himself to the congregation as to what he counsels in private and what he preaches in public. In other words, what he'll be saying is, you men need to get your wives, in such and such an order, and wives, you need to be submissive, and men, you need to be heads, and wives, you need to, be supportive, be that co-pilot and lieutenant and all that. And he says, that's the divine relationship, that's the divine model. Of course, it doesn't work for me, and I don't practice it. And you don't see it in my house, but you all need to do that yourselves. That's how that would translate to, whether he actually came out in those words or not. You must, but I don't, or we don't. A wife who is defiant and uncooperative contradicts the biblical model. She shows disrespect for Christ and her husband. In fact, she brings dishonor to the honorable image of the bride of Christ and how the bride of Christ is submissive to the Lord himself. And by the way, this applies to all wives. This doesn't just apply to men's wives, those men who are seeking to become elders. And a husband who allows his Christian wife to be this defiant and uncooperative person without correcting, without reproof, without holding her to the scriptures, well, it's just as negative. Think about it. If he's unwilling to confront his own wife, how in the world will he be able to confront someone else's wife if she needs to be confronted in his role as an elder? If he is intimidated by his wife's emotions and threats, how will he deal with the intimidations that other people will give him and their threats and their emotions? If he cannot stand up to one woman, then how in the world do we expect him to stand up for the truth, especially when it is unpopular and when everyone else says, let's go the other way? How can we do that? You see what I'm getting at? It is absolutely critical that we have a man who has his marriage under control and his marriage that is following as best as possible the biblical model here. Because otherwise we have a problem with his leadership. Once again, I want to be very clear. We are not appointing his wife. We are not appointing couples to the eldership. At the same time, her conduct is a reflection of her husband's management and therefore must be considered for that reason and that reason alone. In 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2, it says that a man must be a husband of one wife. Literally, in the Greek, that translates to a one-woman man. That is not a job qualification, like we just checked that thing off. It is a character issue that affects his leadership ability and his effectiveness. It identifies or exposes not his marital status. Technically, it identifies and exposes what kind of man he is. Now, here's where we get into that controversial stuff that I was talking about earlier. Not all of you are going to agree with some of the things I'm going to be saying here. And I'm not going to be saying them as if you disagree with me, then we can no longer have fellowship. That's not what I'm doing, is laying that down as a test of fellowship. I am saying, however, just for what it's worth, and please take this into consideration. I've been studying these passages for, well, I hate to even say it this long, but 40 years. I've read many books, thousands of pages of material on this on both sides. I have been studying this, going over this, poring over this for a long time. And the conclusions that I have reached are the result of all of that examination. If you have done less than that, then just take that into consideration. If you just read the passage this morning and says, well, it says husband of one wife, and so, you know, duh, everyone knows what that means. You have not done the kind of examination that passage is worthy of. I'm not saying I'm better than you because I've done that. I'm saying that take into consideration what I'm about to say in light of all of that. So I realize, in short, we're not all going to be on the same page with what I'm going to say here. Traditionally, what this translates to for us in our minds is we need a man who's been married only one time, never divorced, or whatever else. But it doesn't say that, and it doesn't even imply that. If I were to say to you, we need a man with, a man of one car, and you would not be thinking that I could never have had a car before, that the man we're considering has never had a car before. We would be thinking that he has one car right now. In fact, if you look at the word in that phrase, you know, that he needs to be the husband of one wife, that word be is in the present tense. What he is now is what is being considered. Not what he was, not what he will be, not what we think that he was or will be, but what he is right now. That's what be means. What is now? What is he now? Is he a husband of one wife? When reading through the scripture, through the lens of traditional thinking, we tend to see not actually what is said, but what we have been conditioned to read because of traditional influence. It isn't tradition for nothing, okay? Tradition is out there. There's a body of thought out there called tradition, and when we buy into that tradition, we take the conclusions of that tradition and we accept them as our conclusions. What I'm telling you is that sometimes those traditions are correct. Sometimes they are benign, which means they don't really have any effect one way or the other. And sometimes they are incorrect. And they lead us to false conclusions or wrong conclusions about what it is that we should be looking at. In other words, what I'm really saying is that we might have been trained, as I was earlier in my life, we might have been trained to look for a certain conclusion that has already been reached. And now we're going to look into scriptures and find out, yeah, that's what it says, because I know that that's what it must say. That is not good Bible study. That is not open-minded critical thinking. That is not how we should approach the scriptures in any context or any subject. We should be looking for God to bring the conclusion to us, not tradition, not some preacher, not your mom and dad or, you know, your parents or family, not anyone else. Let the Bible says what it says. Because our concern ought to not be what others think, what we've always heard, how we've always read the passage. What we're concerned with here in this passage, on this matter, as in all passages, hopefully, is what is actually being said. Not just verbatim in the lettering and the wording itself, but in the context of the bigger picture. Whether it's the context of 1 Timothy or 1 Timothy 3 itself, or in the context of all of Paul's epistles, or in the context of the New Testament, or even in the context of the Bible. What does it mean there? It seems to me, and I've run into this situation in talking this subject out with people. I'm just going to be candid here. This is a little bit off the chart, but it's valid. It seems to me that a man could have murdered somebody 20, 30 years ago, and done his time and served his, you know, sentence or whatever else, and then become an elder of the congregation because he now fits all of these other things. Seems to me that it would be easier for him to do that than to convince someone that if he's been divorced for any reason, that now he is unfit for the office. I hope you understand what I'm saying. I mean, we can pick a bunch of scenarios that are not talked about in here, and we just dismiss them. But when we see this one thing in our traditional, conditioned way of thinking, we latch onto that and say, boom, disqualify. So I just want you to think about, you know, what Paul is saying and why he's saying it, rather than just simply what you or I have come to believe. Everyone knows that marriage requires commitment and the cooperation of two people, not just one. And while a man should manage his marriage well, that doesn't mean that he always can, because sometimes a wife will not let him. And sometimes it's not the man who leaves his wife, sometimes it's the wife who leaves her man. And if the wife abandons a marriage and ends up, that does end the relationship that the man had with her, but it doesn't redefine his character. And even if he marries again, that creates a new relationship, but it doesn't redefine his character. His character is who he is, not who he's married to. His character is who he is, not his marital status by itself. What is Paul getting at throughout all of 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1? He's talking character, character, character. He's not talking marital status or how many kids he has or what's going on with them with regard to their faith, which is the next point we're getting into, yes. So, what is his character? And with that in mind, what is the character of a husband of one wife in that context? Well, it means that he's legally married to only one man, because if he wasn't, well, that would certainly say something about his character. If he were to have two marriages going on at once, or if he would, you know, not end one and then engage into another one for whatever reason, well, that says not only something about his marital status, but is also his regard for God, his regard for law, and his regard for his own reputation. It does mean that he doesn't share the devotion he has with his wife with some other woman. Doesn't share his loyalty with her, that he has toward her, rather, with some other woman. It means that he's pure and wholesome in his love. He's not lusting after and coveting other women. He's not fantasizing over other women and saying, I wish my wife was, fill in the blank, with some other woman. It means that he is sexually pure as well. Hebrews 13:4 says the marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. Well, he needs to maintain that sexual purity, that sexual fidelity. It means that he's not a ladies' man. He's not a playboy. He's not flirtatious. He's committed. He's devoted. He's bound and cleaves to his own wife. That is a husband of one wife. That is a one-woman man by character definition. In 1 Timothy 5, verse 9, a widow is referred to literally as the wife of one husband. Literally in the Greek, she is a one-man woman. What's interesting about that phrase is that her husband is dead. Just think about that for a minute. Her husband is dead, and yet she's the wife of one husband. Someone would go to that and say, well, see, she can never be. No, it's talking about her character, because that's what's in that. Okay? A woman who is becoming or is regarded as a widow indeed has to have a certain character. And so once again, character issue is more important than marital status in itself. Much more could be said on this, but that's another lesson. I do invite you. I have published work on this, my Titus and James study workbook. I'm saying this not just to sell workbooks, but I have written out pretty expressively on this subject here. In fact, not only this subject, but the subject that we're going to go into right now, which is that of believing children. If you were to go to 1 Timothy chapter 3, as we had looked at last week, 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4 says that the man that we're considering must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under dignity, under control rather, with all dignity. If you go to Titus chapter 1, verse 6, remember Titus and Timothy are both talking about the same kind of man. If Timothy appointed a man and Titus appointed a man, these men would look the same. So we're not talking about two different kinds of elders or two different kinds of candidates. But Titus 1, 6 says that a man is to be above reproach, a husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. The word believe there can be translated faithful. King James Version does translate it such, and so do some others. Traditionally, however, this comes to us as children who are Christians. I used to believe that. I don't believe that anymore. Just as we are not appointing a man's wife, so we are not appointing his children. And just as the spiritual status of a man's wife is not under review, neither is the spiritual status of his children. This is another example of how we've been taught and trained and conditioned to think. We reach a conclusion already, and then we just can't see anything else other than that. I have an appendix in my Titus study workbook that goes 4 or 5 pages worth of information on this, and you would be a good Bible student to read that, even if it doesn't change your mind. You would be a good Bible student to read through that and be challenged with that. Traditionally, what we've said about this is believe or faithful always means Christian. First of all, this is not true. It just isn't true. And I would respectfully challenge anyone who says it is true to go into your Bible and prove that. You'll find that the huge preponderance of evidence is in favor of Christian or faithful or believing, meaning a adverbial phrase rather than faithful something or faithful to, rather than meaning the faithful, as in Christian. Secondly, it almost always refers to being responsible, sure, or trustworthy. What's interesting is if you're in Titus 1 still, look down in verse 9. It says that the elder must be one who, elder candidate rather, holding fast the faithful word. That word faithful there is the exact same Greek word from which we get faithful or believing in verse 6. So what is he saying there? Well, the word is not a Christian. It doesn't say the Christian word. It says faithful word, trustworthy word. Sure word, a word that it can be counted on. Thirdly, when we talk about, you know, that says Christians there, then we're reading something into the text because the context has to do with the man, not with his children up front. Faithful to or believing in God adds a new subject to the context and does ignore the subject that is actually stated. So when we say that faithful there means Christian, what we're doing is we're saying now he needs to be faithful to God, even though we've been talking about the man, and God isn't mentioned yet anywhere in that passage. So who is mentioned? The man is mentioned. Who are the children faithful to? I propose to you that they are being faithful to their father, the man, not to God. Now, does that mean that they should be unfaithful to God? It doesn't mean that, but it just means that that's Paul's point. Paul's point is that we're examining the man and how he manages his household, how he manages his children. So children who believe doesn't explicitly say who they are faithful to or believe in. Grammatically, faithful needs a subject. You can't just say of someone, well, they're faithful. Because without a subject, you don't know what they're faithful in. You don't know what they're faithful to or who they're faithful to. You need to have a subject. And what I'm telling you is grammatically and otherwise, the subject here is the man and not God. So the emphasis, the context here is the child's faithfulness or the children's faithfulness to their father. This bears on the man's leadership ability. Furthermore, once those children leave the father's house, he can't lead them anymore in that capacity. He's still their father. That's true. They still should honor him as their father. That's true. But they don't have to obey him as they would if they were under his roof. Because that's a different scenario. You can't lead someone that is outside of your, I'm going to use the word jurisdiction here. Okay? I mean, we're just talking about elder, all the things we've been talking about, shepherds. Our shepherds here, our elders here, do not have jurisdiction over people in a different congregation. They don't know who they are, and even if they did, they can't lead them because they're not here. They're not part of this family. They're not under this roof, so to speak. Don't take that too literal. So once the children leave a father's house, he can't lead them. And that so this all pertains to children who are in his household and under his roof and are within his sphere of leadership. Think about it. When children get out of the house and get married, they start their own households. When are we supposed to end that relationship of the child, you know, being tied to his father when they started their own household? It just doesn't make sense to maintain that indefinitely. Not at all. Not accused of dissipation or rebellion. This doesn't refer to the man, but rather the child. That the children need to be submissive and respectful. It doesn't mean, however, that the children will never disappoint, because we all know that children do, and that we as children did. We're not talking about zero incidents of rebellion, because all children rebel in some way or another. But we're talking about overall lifestyle and character. Do they honor and respect and love and support the parents because they've been taught to do so? Is this a well-managed house? And is he a good manager of that house? This is what it all comes down to. We're looking at the man. Can he manage his own household? Why? Well, because 1 Timothy 3:5 says, if a man can't manage his own house, then why in the world would we give to him more responsibility to manage a whole bunch of people? That just doesn't make sense. Child who lives and conducts this way, conducts himself this way, in other words, honoring his father and respecting him and so on, that is no accident. So Paul implies a father's responsibility in the matter. Leadership, by the way, is no accident. While exceptions can exist about children, the children's behavior provides a general insight or guide to the character of the father. Here's a common rebuttal, and I used to believe this myself. I used to argue this myself. If a Christian man can't lead his children to believe in the Lord, how in the world can he lead others to believe in the Lord? Sounds good, right? Sounds up front, airtight, and hands down, end of discussion right there. Let's just leave it at that. And the fact of the matter is, that is a personal opinion. That is perhaps your personal opinion. And I'll respect that if you want to hold that opinion. But I challenge you to go into the scriptures and find out where that is actual doctrinal fact. Because if it is doctrine, then we need God to weigh in on the matter. Not me, not you, not us. It's just a personal opinion that's not supported by context or the scripture. Not even Jesus could do this. There were a bunch of men put under his charge, and not all of them were obedient to him. So this conclusion is what many people want Paul to say or think that Paul said, but the words and the context do not actually say this. And honestly, I'll give this to you. I'll concede the point in the sense that if you think that a man should lead his children to the Lord in order to be a good church leader, well then, I respect that. But at the same time, if you're going to disqualify a man based on your opinion of him, based on your opinion of this passage, What did you just do? You just inserted your opinion on par with doctrine. And we cannot do this. I cannot do this. Someone says, well, yeah, but he's in rebellion to his father if he doesn't obey the Lord. Really? So the father commands his children to obey the Lord, and they must submit to their earthly father in order to be obedient to the Lord. Where, in what other capacity does that ever work? These are not interchangeable subjects. We're not talking apples to apples. We have no right to hold a man, or a woman for that matter, responsible for any person besides himself with regard to faithfulness. God does not hold me responsible for my wife's faithfulness. He does not hold me responsible for my children's faithfulness to him. I'm responsible ultimately for my own faithfulness. Now, should I teach and govern and inspire and so on for someone else? Of course. But responsible for? That's a different story. We can't say on one hand, no man is perfect, and then require him to have a perfect marriage and perfect family as measured by our personal standards and expectations before we deem that man capable and qualified to lead. That is unfair. That is unwarranted. And as I said earlier, it doesn't make sense and cannot be biblically defended to disqualify a man simply based on his children's allegiance to the Lord or not. We must be very careful not to disqualify a good man simply based on their personal interpretation of this passage. I know I've been pretty bold on this point, and again, I want to stress that I'm not laying this down as a test of fellowship or that you have to agree with me in order for us to be friends. That's not what I'm saying here. But I'm saying, remember what I said, I've been studying this a long time. At least take that into account and do your own due diligence. Do your own homework on this before you come back with your own final analysis. I've literally had people do this. I've gone through this whole thing. I've talked, I've preached, I've written all this, and then someone just waves that away and says, yeah, but I've always believed. And then, boom, there it is. That's not good Bible study. Okay? With all due respect, it really doesn't matter what you've always believed. Honestly, it doesn't even matter what I've always believed. What matters is what's true. What matters is what God says. A well-managed or poorly managed household is a direct reflection on the character, the nature, and the moral fitness of the candidate himself. Like a large tree that falls in a storm is due to internal decay, or certainly can be, so a man may have a good public showing, but long-term measurement of his home life may reveal something other than that. What we want is a good, solid tree. We want a good, solid tree. We don't want necessarily or shouldn't be looking for a perfect tree, a tree with no broken branches, you know, nothing marred on the bark, if you will, you know, every tree perfect and intact. We don't need that, but we do need a good, solid tree. And that's really what we're looking for in a candidate for an elder. A husband or father cannot force his wife or children to obey God. But if he cannot command admiration and respect as a man, then he is not a viable or effective leader or a steward. These are leadership and stewardship issues here. It's extremely important to consider that when considering an elder. Godly stewardship is not limited, however, to elder candidates. Godly stewardship is something that applies directly to all Christians and all Christian men especially, but even applies to women in their own realms of leadership as a woman, as a wife, as a mother, as a teacher, as a Christian. So don't think that stewardship is just something that elder candidates need to have and I can just do my own thing, okay? You need to see this as this is something we all should be striving to not only have but also to perfect over time. So that leads to my last point here is what kind of steward are you? Been looking at a lot of different scenarios here. Been looking at men that we are considering for eldership, whether in the near future or the distant future, either way. Been looking at that. But what about you? Are you taking care of things entrusted to you? Are you taking care of people who have been entrusted to you? Are you taking care of responsibilities that have been entrusted to you? Do you realize that you will be held accountable for the things that you've been entrusted with? What about your marriage? Does it hold up to the biblical model? Is it healthy and loving? Not just because you said so or because your wife just nudged you and says, say the right word, okay? But because it really is healthy and loving. What about fathers? Are your children under your control? Are they faithful to you? Do they believe in your leadership and do they believe in your headship? Do they honor you as the head of that household? Do they honor that? By the way, household extends not only to children, but anyone who is living under your roof. Everyone needs to be on board with who is in charge of that household. Again, it is hypocritical for us to hold candidates for elders to high, high standards, but then let us go with very low standards. And we're not looking for perfect men, otherwise we'd never have elders. But we are looking for good trees, if you will, men who are capable of doing the job. That's my series. I know we've said a lot. The handouts are there for your after-sermon perusal. And I hope that you do read over this and go over these scriptures again. That's what they're there for. I hope that you take seriously what we're embarking on here very shortly, within a month. We're going to be looking at doing all of this. I hope you remember what has been said and that you take all these things to heart. That's our lesson this morning. If there's anyone who is subject to this gospel message that we have been preaching, the truth of God, and we want you to respond positively, obediently to God, if that is your desire, and come forward if you need to as we stand and sing the song Bob has selected for us here.